quivering leaves.
It has a history as tightly packed with stories as these courts are with blades of grass. This richness of colour, you know immediately where you are. It has sounds all of its own.
You cannot be serious!
This place and I. Let's say we go back.
Good evening. Well, the men's singles final, as it should be, was between the two best players in the world.
Wimbledon. A word. A place. A love affair. I'm going to meet some of the greats of tennis to see if they feel the same way about this place as I do.
I was in awe of the whole place. Yeah, it was just amazing.
I grew up dreaming and reading about Wimbledon my whole life.
Get fresh with ice cream.
You could feel the traditional or magic thing who was in there, inside those gates.
Shock flew up.
It was the first real time that I remember being booed.
It changed my life so much that I called Wimbledon my home.
When you walk out on center court, there's such a hush before everybody explodes.
A rush of fans.
Walking through the gates, everything was so new, and it's like living in a dream world.
Love the court, love the atmosphere of the place, the echo of the ball, the royalty in the box. Like, it was just, it was different.
Sue Barker, Our Wimbledon. Wimbledon, London.
Ladies and gentlemen, quiet please.
I've been coming here since I was 10. And every time I pass through these gates, it still gets to me. It's a very British place, and it puts on a show at the height of our summer, which means you have to come prepared for anything.
Court violation, verbal abuse, point penalty, Mr. Tango.
That's it!
The pain of it. This is a personal journey into what sets Wimbledon apart, of coming close, but not quite being one of these. A Wimbledon champion, and what it allows you to do.
No, you, I can't believe you just touched that.
This is off the record.
Am I ready? Born ready.
Spencer Gore was the winner of the first men's title back in 1877, watched by just 200 people. After the match, he said, "Lawn tennis, it's a bit boring. It'll never catch on." Now, look where we are, with all of this being broadcast to millions around the globe.
As soon as it could, the BBC came to Wimbledon. And before the age of television, radio was here. As far back as 1927, and putting on record a golden age in the 30s.
Now we're going to take you over to Wimbledon for a running commentary on the All English Championship.
Here's the great man himself. Fred Perry won it 3 times. Fred's last win came in 1936, a year before the BBC began its experiment of televising play on the centre court. They'd be highly experienced by the time the next player from our islands became men's singles champion. 77 years, the long, tough wait.
Hello! I'm all right. How are you?
Nice things.
All right, yeah. Nice being around here.
So quiet. I mean, this bit here, I mean, this, during the tournament, is packed. Obviously, this with all the royal box.
We don't get in here.
Stuff. You're not allowed in here.
No.
You should be.
Can we mic him up now and just get that on tape?
This is how tough it can be.
Right, I'm going to try this, and it's not going to be easy.
Andy Murray is in tears, and his wife, Kim, is also crying in the family box.
Everybody always talks about the pressure of playing at Wimbledon, how tough it is, but it's not the people watching. They make it so much easier to play. The support has been incredible, so thank you.
You can be very
2012 loss was a really tough one for me. For a few days after, I was still, you know, was upset, not just on the court, but, you know, off the court when, you know, when I got home. It was hard. But I also, around that time, that was when I also accepted that, you know, I may never win one of these tournaments, you know, and that was a big moment for me.
And I think it turned a corner because I think you felt the affection from the public as well.
I felt like when I was growing up, like in the spotlight and stuff, that I found it difficult. I found it really hard, and it came at a very early age for me when I played on centre court the first time when I was 18. And, you know, literally 2-3 weeks beforehand, you know, I was playing in front of like 5 or 10 people maximum, and all of a sudden I was on centre court. And my life changed like very quickly, and I found that hard, really hard to deal with. And I sort of shut myself off from, you know, a lot of the media. So a lot of people saw me as just being like, maybe they still do, as just being boring, doesn't show any emotion. And obviously in that moment, you know, I was clearly very upset.
For me, I dreamed of playing on centre court and I was lucky enough to do it. And for me, it's a magical place. I cannot imagine what you must feel when you come out here with what you've achieved.
Yeah, I mean, this court is obviously, it would be the most famous tennis court in the world. So, yeah, anytime you come out here, it does have a slightly different feeling. And I feel like it helps me. Like, I feel the pressure for sure and I find it stressful, but also I never feel like I'm struggling to concentrate or struggling for motivation. Like when I'm out on this court, it sort of just happened.
12 months later, he was doing it all again.
Andy Murray looks to put 77 years of hurt behind British tennis.
I couldn't remember much of the game itself.
Andy is playing Djokovic.
When I came off the court, I was asked, you know, immediately after the match, like, what happened in the last game? And I was like, I literally couldn't remember hardly any of the points at all.
Advantage, Murray.
Andy serves for the championship. It's returned and the crowd think it's out, but Andy has to hit it. And when Djokovic attempts to send it back, it strikes the net.
The waiting is over.
You looked like you were sort of disorientated because at the end of it, I think you thought you were looking up at your box when you were down the other end and you sort of screamed at the press box.
I don't know exactly why I did it into towards that corner. I don't know who I was looking at in particular or if I was doing it towards the press, or I know that the commentary box is also right there as well, but yeah.
We've waited 77 years for this. The men's singles champion at Wimbledon 2013, Andy Murray.
Andy gets a standing ovation as he raises the trophy above his head.
From the reigning champion who cast off the burden of history to a maker of history. West Coast America, California, home of one tough Australian. Perhaps the greatest men's singles champion of them all, Rod Laver, who also helped change Wimbledon forever.
When I grew up, he was my idol, Laver. I mean, I wanted to be like him on the court.
He, because of his record, he stands alone in a way, and that's why I think it's really important to honour the greats of the game.
Rod Laver straddled the two ages of tennis, the amateur and the professional, and was a colossus of them both.
At 17, you know, I worked through the gates at Wimbledon. I was in awe of the whole place.
He remains the only player to have twice held the four Grand Slam titles in a calendar year, in 1962 and 1969. His first Wimbledon title came in 1961.
Centre Court at Wimbledon, there's only one. Everything is so close, and their knowledge of the game is so much more accurate because they know exactly who's playing, any of the history behind it.
And off the wood!
1961 champion after 56 minutes play.
Fred Perry was timing it at the side of the court, one of the quickest Wimbledon finals he had ever seen.
Yeah, I guess I'd been in the final 2 years prior and I figured third time lucky, I guess, I'm hoping.
Do you remember what prize you received for winning Wimbledon?
I got a £10 voucher and a firm handshake.
And what did you blow your £10 voucher on?
And I wasn't allowed to cash it. Otherwise, they would have turned me pro. So I went to Lily White's and got a got a shirt, I think.
For winning Wimbledon.
A simply tremendous display by Rod Laver that will go certainly down in the history of this game.
1962, to be able to win all four titles.
But you can't just gloss over, I won all four Grand Slams like that, Bob, because this is, as we've seen, one of the hardest things to do. How hard was it back then?
Yeah, certainly it was tough. And I had the good fortune of having the Queen there to present me with the trophy.
But there'd be no more of this for 6 years. In late 1962, he turned professional.
A lot of the tennis world back in those years didn't quite understand. They thought that we could just travel around and not ever have any need for money. And I think, how do you... It doesn't work that way. And so finally, I decided that I had to turn professional, and I signed for $110,000 for 3 years of playing for 11 months a year. I became a tennis player when I turned professional. Could I get back to Wimbledon again? That's over.
Professionals were barred from Grand Slam events, including Wimbledon. But the club chairman, Herman David, was campaigning to let them play and staged a pro tournament in 1967. The BBC covered it as an experiment in colour television.
The place was packed out for the last 3 days, and then Herman David said, you're invited to play in next year's Wimbledon. I know the Australian and the French and the US were not too amused, but they, you know, came to a part of saying, well, why don't we all have open tennis?
The first Open Championships, 1968. Rod was back, better than ever.
The greatest prize of all, the first Open Wimbledon.
It's probably my most favourite tournament ever. And so being able to go out there again and compete, yeah, it was just amazing.
The Dance of the Champions. In 1969, Rod completed his last set of Grand Slam titles. The full set again, making him unique.
Those treasures don't come back, but they're just amazing to think that Louis lived through that era. For me, it was just... It meant so much to be able to be at Wimbledon, you know, being able to play and feel like, you know, it was almost a second home.
Can I just say on behalf of everyone in tennis, thank you for everything that you did during that time and where you have helped take tennis. It wouldn't be the same without. I have a little picture that I treasure, Rod. This was when I was... That's not a little boy in the middle, that is actually me. When I was 12 years old and you came over to London, and I actually won one of your rackets, and it was I used the same grip, the same thing, that racket for the whole of my career, and I absolutely treasure that. It's on my wall. You've made such a huge impact on me as well.
Sue, it's my pleasure to be part of this great game and to be with you.
At Wimbledon.
We're now into the members' lounge, so we get to use this throughout the year, but during the tournament, this is purely for the Royal Box, the Royal guests and all of the people they invite to the Royal Box, and this is the way they go, from having their lovely refreshments through this door. There's one on the other side, exactly the same.
Royals entering the box.
And then out onto centre court. All the seats, obviously, are taken away during the year. Never been in here myself, other than days like today.
The Royal Connection. King George VI played in the men's doubles here. Mostly, they watch and make players nervous.
The worst part was when you used to have to turn around at the service line and do the curtsy. Oh, my God.
I don't think anybody's particularly practiced at their curtsies.
I think I asked Billie Jean, how do you curtsy? Except she really went down on her knees. And I go, well, that's because you volley like that.
I think that was the most difficult thing to do.
The most regular of the royals in their best seats in the house is the Duke of Kent. The Queen's cousin has been president of the All England Lawn Tennis Club for nearly 50 years.
My first Wimbledon as president was 69. Mm-hmm. I actually stood in for my mother in 68, which, when she was ill. That was the first time that I handed over a trophy to Rod Laver.
Yes.
And so that was, for me, a rather memorable year.
The tournament has evolved, but the feel of the tournament hasn't changed.
I think they've been remarkably successful in evolving the thing, so that we still have a place which looks discreet, which has a beautiful green grass, which isn't plastered with advertisements everywhere, or painted bright blue or something. And I think people do admire that aspect of it. I mean, it may be rather silly to pay so much attention to traditions, but it does seem to matter to people.
Do you get a sense of the national pride within Centre Court?
Oh, yes, certainly. And the crowd are not always exactly impartial. They make it pretty clear whom they favour. And it was, I mean, it was a terrific atmosphere that day for Andy Murray's victory. We all prayed it was going to happen, but you could never count on it, can you?
The brief is to watch and present the prizes, but also to comfort the runners-up. You have to go onto the court to talk to them.
Yes, and they can't speak. Well, you interview them. They can't speak, can they, really? No.
It's not easy to know what to say to them, particularly the runner-up who comes up first.
And occasionally they're quite emotional, too.
They are very emotional. And one of the most emotional involved the Duchess of Kent of All Highness when Jana Novotná lost to Steffi Graf. I think that for many people that's one of the most famous images of Wimbledon.
Yes, because it was quite unexpected. You know, she was break down in tears as she was being presented with the runner-up trophy. And she just couldn't contain herself, I think, and my wife comforted her. It was a very nice, spontaneous moment.
You must be so proud of the tournament, because I've travelled the world talking to so many of the great champions, and every single one of them talks about their love for the championships and the tradition, and that must make you very proud as president.
I think that's very palpable, isn't it? Almost every one of the should I say, senior players that I've met all say they want to win Wimbledon more than any other championship, which is rather wonderful.
A pair of players give the Royal Box some rather awkward bows. Manhattan, New York.
Not exactly leafy SW19 anymore. This is New York City. Remember Wimbledon's part in the tennis revolution of the 1960s? Well, I'm here to meet the mother of the revolution. On court, off court, the player who changed everything in women's tennis.
Time now to meet Wimbledon's most prolific champion, a remarkable lady who has done more to advance the cause of women's sport than anyone before or since. Her record tally of 20 titles here, 6 in singles, 10 in doubles, 4 in mixed, sets her apart. Billie Jean King.
Hi.
Wow.
How are you? Good to see you.
Good.
I'm Billie.
He's into tennis.
Oh, good. Hi, I'm Billie Jean.
Great
good to see
you.
And this is Sue Barker, who also played.
Hi.
Sue Barker is the superstar on BBC, literally.
Wow.
20 Wimbledon titles, a record equaled, but never bettered.
I'm assuming this is Sue.
Yep.
1979, her last Wimbledon title. 1961, her first. Between the ages of 17 and 35, nobody has ever felt more at home here.
What was your impression of walking onto Centre Court? Because everyone talks about it.
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. I love tradition. I love the process. I love that we walk into this. In the old days, they had a little waiting room, and you sit in there, and they had the different photos of players that came before. And of course, I knew all of them and knew their history. But it's tough because you have to sit in there with your opponent sometimes.
I remember looking out that window. Do you remember the two little windows where
Chris,
you could sit on?
Chris and I had to wait a day to play our finals. We were there together. There's a photo of Chris and I looking out of that window. We were there the whole day.
The black and white shot of Billie Jean and Chris Evert peeking out of the window.
When I walk on Centre Court, I always am thanking all the past champions that came before me. I think about people who never got to play there. And then I think about the future, like which future champions are going to be here when I was playing.
Others had thought of her. Neighbours who raised $2,000 to finance her first trip to Wimbledon. She won the doubles, which earned her no money, but an invitation.
The Wimbledon ball that year.
We couldn't go.
So what did you do?
Because we couldn't afford it. We had $3 left. So Karen and I went out in Knightsbridge someplace. I went downstairs to this Italian restaurant. And we had dinner. I'm sure we had pasta or something, spaghetti or something.
Putting food on the table, Billie Jean became a driving force on all fronts, a champion on court and off it, a pioneer of the women's professional tour, creating it, fighting for its survival, and then fighting for equality. Thanks to her, the women players of today have the same prize money as the men.
I am so happy I came up in the 70s. Women's tennis just exploded because of Billie Jean King.
At Wimbledon, you were fighting so hard as well off the court.
Yes, off the court.
Do you think that, you know, affected in some ways, you know...
My performance?
Well, yeah.
Oh, sure. I didn't win as much. I didn't care. I had this vision when I was younger that how I wanted the game to look, and I wanted men and women to be together, working hard together. And because the men rejected us, we didn't have one association. Our dream, the nine of us, we decided was that if any girl in the world was born, she'd have a place to play and compete. The other reason was we wanted them to be appreciated for their accomplishments, not just their looks.
A signpost at Wimbledon pointing out the tea lawn, museum and shop.
If I said to you a sentence that would sum up Wimbledon.
Pure splendor, just pure heaven. I don't know, it's just the gardens and the ivy and the surroundings, the people, the fans. I remember talking to Roy Emerson, who I absolutely adore. He's won so many titles at Wimbledon. And I'll never forget him telling me, he says, Billy, what keeps me going is when I'm at Wimbledon and I walk in and I see all those people been up all night to see us, he says, we are so lucky. And he's right.
A water tank on a flat roof, then yellow cabs. Sue's in the back of one of them, making its way to Central Park.
Still in New York, still turbulent. For me, this is a tricky one. The mid-1970s, there was a rivalry between me and...
Virginia Wade.
Oh, my God, David! Look at you! You look $1 million! Fantastic! This is great!
We were both Grand Slam champions. I'd won the French Open, Virginia, the US and the Australian, but hopes of an all-British final were scuppered when I lost to Betty Stover in the semis, so only Virginia made it to the 1977 final.
I was just quite relieved, I have to say, that it was not a certain Sue Barker who won that match.
Betty cost me a fortune because I couldn't bear to watch the final.
No,
so I went out and spent an absolute fortune on jewellery.
That's very funny.
So you made 13,000 and I spent a whole load.
That's a very funny story, so I don't think I've ever heard that one.
This is what I missed that July Friday. The Queen, 25 years on the throne, here to see Virginia in her first Wimbledon final.
It was incredible motivation that she was going to be there. Everybody was very excited. So they all have Union Jacks and their flags everywhere. And, you know, it was sort of cool because she was dressed in the same color as my cardigan. It matched my lucky dress.
Why was it the lucky dress?
Well, because I was winning in it. And it washed very easily. And so that was such a good omen when you go in and then you see the Queen's wearing the same colour. I mean, that was really very fortuitous.
I'd said before the tournament, I don't know if I'd said it in public, but I kept saying it to whoever I was speaking to. I said, if I get to the final of Wimbledon this year, I'll win it.
Her opponent hits the net.
That's a bad error.
The feeling of match point. Here I am, one point away from the dream becoming reality.
Well, it was one of the things that I'd really been working on, this particular forehand return of a second serve. And lo and behold, that was the shot I got. And lo and behold, that was the execution that won the day.
She's done it. She's done it. A fairy story comes true.
Were you aware of just what it meant to the British public to have a Wimbledon champion?
It was like they were desperate for a celebration, and it gave them a reason to celebrate. And I think it elevated a lot of people's moods.
Ladies and gentlemen, the score was 4-6, 6-3, 6-1.
And finally, having my record being very debatable in the eyes of the British public, I suddenly could do no wrong, so...
The Queen presents her trophy.
Do you remember what she said to you?
No, I couldn't hear her. There was so much noise going on. So I said, pardon? I still didn't hear. Excuse me? Still didn't hear, so I thought I'd better not say.
What a proud and happy girl.
Wimbledon is the golden globe you're aiming for. And in retrospect, it changed my life a lot.
Virginia, it must seem like the fulfillment of a dream.
No, it was just like fairyland out there. I saw the fairy tale and it made you very insignificant to be part of it, you know, but it was nice to know that you were.
Footage of Virginia holding aloft the Venus Rosewater dish.
We should go and have some lunch. There's a hot dog stall there, or we could go to that very expensive restaurant. Are you paying? Which way are we going?
We're going this way. We're going this way.
She didn't say she'd pay. And by the entrance to Centre Court, the busts of the five lady champions from Great Britain, including Angela Mortimer from 61, Anne Jones in 69, and Virginia in 77. Conditions were fine for Virginia's win, but the year before, it was hot. Really hot. And I'm not talking about the weather.
Hey, she's live. 60. Yeah, it's smashing. It's quite something. It really is.
Bjorn Borg was the biggest rock star tennis has ever seen.
And even on the centre court, we've got the teenagers rushing on. I've never seen this before in my life.
There were literally like a couple hundred girls screaming outside like it was the Beatles arriving in America. I thought to myself, now, this would be nice to be able to get a little bit of that.
Stockholm, Sweden.
You in some ways changed tennis. Now they have tunnels underneath Wimbledon, but you guys, you'd have to leave the locker room and fight your way to get to practice courts, which can't have been easy.
No, it was different during our time. You remember too, so.
I do. But you used to get mobbed. I used to see outside the window. You could tell when you were walking out because there was this whole sea, all the policemen surrounding you.
Well, something happened in tennis during that time. You know, staying in a hotel, you know, you stay in your room, and in the reception was like hundreds of girls standing downstairs. It was like crazy. But we were used to do that. I mean, that's the way we're supposed to do. It was crazy. Today is different. Tennis is different. Everything is different today than when we play.
Everyone a fluffy one. Come on, girls, it's agony on the ball.
One Bjorn, enjoying the glow and all that came with it. And the other, the 20-year-old ice-cold Swede, in his first final against Ilya Nastasi, 10 years his senior.
When you walk out to the Wimbledon final and centre court, it's a special thing. The first 3-4 games, I was very nervous.
You never looked nervous.
Yeah, but I was very nervous.
3 championship points for Borg. That's it!
And after winning the last point in a Wimbledon final, that's the most beautiful thing, what can happen to you as a tennis player. Finally, you're a Wimbledon champion. It's something special, something extra.
It went beyond extra special. He could not lose at Wimbledon. And he did it his way. The unbeatable Borg. 1, 2, 3, 4 titles in succession.
Now we're all wondering here, Bjorn, whether you can make it 5. Do you think you can?
I hope so. Why not?
Or even 6 or 7.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind.
The fifth final, 1980, against John McEnroe. What was he like in the locker room before a final? Did he try and talk to you?
You know, I'm kind of a private person. You know, I sit and do my things. But he was the same, and he didn't say a word. Nothing.
Saved it for on court,
did he? Saved his just exactly, he saved it to the court. So have something to say.
Everybody talks about the 1980 final and that fourth set tiebreak.
To date, since we first saw the tiebreak in 1971, no final has ever ended on the tiebreak, but it might now.
I felt like my game matched up really well to him, and he had won four in a row, and what are the odds of a guy winning five in a row?
So many unbelievable shots we did, both me and John.
Borg misses a return.
On and on went the fourth set tiebreak. 20 minutes. Bjorn to win again and John to stay in the final.
Yes, two sets all.
Borg was one of those guys, never got tired. And I started to physically feel like, oh my God, it just caught up to me. And then next thing I know, he's on his knees.
That's it.
Borg's winning shot.
He wouldn't win again. And soon, he was gone from Wimbledon. His last centre court match was the 1981 final, this time losing to John McEnroe.
It never happened to me before in my life that, okay, I lost. I'm not that disappointed. Then I felt there was something wrong with me. I could not go anywhere. I could not do anything. And I was crazy. In the end, I said, I cannot live this kind of life. I'm fed up. Maybe it would have been nice to play another 3 or 5 years in tennis. I was 25 years old. But I think that had a big part why I stepped away from tennis.
He did come back 20 years later. Not to play, just to be adored again.
It's Bjorn Borg!
A resounding reception.
I mean, what a welcome back it was to centre court by the crowd.
Yes, it was very nice. It felt really good in my heart. Because Wimbledon, it's a special thing for me. It's the most special tournament for me. I mean, of all the tournaments I played all over the world, those wins and, you know, being there, playing there, it's deep inside my heart.
The River Thames.
The player that ended the reign of Bjorn Borg was just about everything the inscrutable Swede was not. Well, John, do you enjoy coming to London?
Oh, I enjoy it quite a bit now. You know, when I was playing, it was a lot more difficult to enjoy. There was some self-inflicted wounds and some pressure, obviously, a lot of pressure, most of which I put on myself. But, you know, I came here for one reason only, which is to try to win Wimbledon.
1977, an 18-year-old rookie from New York making an impression.
I had played Phil Dent in the French Open. And there were a lot of bad calls in this match at the French. So he sort of put his arm around my shoulder. He goes, son, this is the pros now. So if you want to question a call, you got to go to ask the umpire. You know, don't go look at me. So this light bulb went off in my head. I didn't know when or if this opportunity would present itself. Ironically, we played in the quarters at Wimbledon.
Well, he's not going to like it.
For the first time that I recall, I started to question calls.
You're quite sure?
7-all.
Oh, the ball was so far in. You see it in?
I got frustrated. I ended up losing the first set in a tiebreaker. And I remember I tried to take my racket and, you know, I grabbed my racket. It was wood rackets. And I was just couldn't believe I lost this set.
Well, he has a right to be disappointed. Whether he has a right to make such a fuss is debatable.
It was the first real time that I remember being booed. So I thought, why are they booing? So I decided, just to see what they react, I put the racket on the ground, kick it towards where I was going to sit, just to see if they reacted to that, which they did. That suddenly completely changed my life.
He's done it. A wonderful win. Marvellous win for this young fellow of 18.
He was a little bit lost in the beginning. He has a temper and he was behaving bad. And all the other tennis players, they said, we don't like this guy, you know. They didn't accept him as a person and as a player.
It was the wrong decision.
But you can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious! That ball was on the line. Chalk flew up.
Some of it obviously was my fault, but I didn't feel like I deserved quite the shellacking I was getting.
You guys are the absolute tits of the world.
I'm going to award a point against you, Mr. McEnroe.
By the time I played Borg in 81, the notoriety that I was receiving was getting to be very distracting. Everything was magnified, so I had to be really careful about not really doing anything, otherwise it would just look like I was going absolutely crazy. I had a tendency to sort of get distracted and lash out at times, but this one I was under control.
That's it. He's won it. He's won it.
When you look back at it now, do you think it did distract you?
I think it did. I think I would have been a better player had I not. Others disagree. They think I used harnesses energy to whatever, throw off the opponent. But ultimately, I think the way I played prepared me well. But there were times where I felt like it got in the way of the things. But then again, maybe I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you.
A New Yorker who would be both booed and loved by Wimbledon. 3 singles titles, 5 doubles. A brat and a magician, singled out as a bad example, universally adored. A complex personality in a theatre of many moods, and still very much here. Today, his verbal outbursts are admired around the world.
A display of tennis dresses.
Dressed to thrill from the 1920s, look at that. Now, there is one dress in here that actually belongs to me. And it's that one. That was made for me by the great tennis designer Teddy Tinling. And he asked me what I wanted in a dress, and I said, make me a dress of what you think I am. And he made me that. I'm very gold lame, apparently. How times have changed.
Tennis fans wearing a variety of statement outfits across the decades.
Wimbledon has always had a white-only dress code, a code never broken, but stretched.
The backless dress is the halter.
We talk about collars versus no collars. Cashmere sweater with my initials.
Cardigans, sort of the jackets, even the long pants, even the vests.
The sundresses, the dresses with cutouts.
And the whole crowd went, whoa!
It was pretty fashionable back then, don't you think?
Andre Agassi pushes the dress code by taking his top off, while stars of the game offer a range of looks all the way up to Pat Cash's iconic black and white check sweatband.
Tennis lends itself to actually look very good.
Roger Federer. Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
We're light years from Wimbledon. This is tennis country, USA. Fort Lauderdale in the southernmost state of Florida. You won't find too many grass courts here, but Wimbledon reaches out, and a teenager from this town knew exactly why she had to go.
The beauty of Wimbledon is it's like the tennis cathedral, because there's such a reverence about that center court. And when you walk out, there's such a hush before everybody explodes. You don't get that at any other Grand Slam on center court.
Chris Evert.
I can't believe you're down here.
I can't believe I'm here. I was a 17-year-old protected schoolgirl from Florida. England, London seemed so far away across the ocean. Wimbledon was special because you walk into that tea room and you look around, there'd be every player there, and you go, oh my God, Bjorn Borg over there, and Rod Laver was over there, and Billie Jean was over here. And I mean, it was really the social scene of London, really, at that time.
You, in some way, were the first person that made women's sport sexy.
I always wanted to be feminine, and being feminine while I was on the court sweating, and while I was on the court, you know, really trying my best, was important to me. You don't have to be big and tall and muscular, and I wasn't the greatest athlete, but I made it happen. And so I think I gave hope to little girls all around the world that if I try really, really hard and I work hard and I want it badly enough, I've got a shot at this. I think that that's what my appeal was.
Hashtag my Wimbledon memory.
Okay, what happened there? You didn't, right, but also, if you're gonna commit and poach, you've gotta go in. You don't go sideways. Okay, cut it off and go in. I see things. I didn't do them, but I see things.
Chris won 3 Wimbledon singles, but 1974 was the year. A headline writer's dream. Her fiancé, Jimmy Connors, won 2.
That was also 74 when they called it the love double.
Oh, 74. I don't think the two of you were off the front page.
Yeah, people were intrigued with 2 young tennis players that were in love and that were going to get married. It was like a Cinderella story. You know, it was fantastic. And I remember he beat Ken Rosewall in the finals, and I sat next to his mom and Ava Gardner.
Wow.
Yeah, Wimbledon brings out special people.
So did you have to dance together when you won that?
We did, and we danced to The Girl of My Dreams. And I remember I saw a picture of it, and I'm wearing like 7-inch stilettos. My hair was like down to here, and you know, we were both pretty immature, but we were kind of caught up in the story too, I think. And it never, you know, when 2 people are trying to be number one in the world, it's never going to work.
Chris was undisputed world number one, a Wimbledon favorite until a rival emerged, not from Sunkist Florida, but from Jevenice near Prague in then communist Czechoslovakia. So, Martina, this is home. Not far. Your home is how far from here?
It's about 300 yards down the hill.
But this is like the center of the village.
Yes. Where... This used to be cobblestones, but then they paved the road. So riding the bicycle was a bit of a precarious proposition.
When she was 18, Martina left home for America. It would make life hard for the family she left behind. Behind the Iron Curtain.
That was the hardest thing that I've ever had to do, which is, you know, after that, playing a match, even coming out, piece of cake, you know, when you consider what I did when I was 19, almost 19, didn't know when I was gonna see my parents again, didn't know if I was gonna see them alive. When I won my first Wimbledon, I was stateless. I was officially not from anywhere.
In rejecting her home country, it wasn't just Martina who suffered. Her family were isolated, lost their jobs, and prevented from leaving the country. We all felt for you in that Wimbledon final when your family couldn't come to watch you in 78.
I didn't even know if they were able to watch, because Czech TV didn't show it. They would show Wimbledon until I started winning, and then they wouldn't show it. That's how people knew I was in the finals, when they didn't show the final. They would write about the tournament and then kind of ignore my half of the draw.
Navratilova wins.
That's it. That's it. And a truly wonderful victory for Martina, 2-6.
Finally saw my mom in 79, 4 years later, when she came to Wimbledon, when the Duchess of Kent helped get her visa.
It's like long lost daughter or son coming from war, almost, you know, at some point we didn't even know if we would ever see each other again.
It's 4 years since you last saw her in the flesh.
4.5.
How has she changed?
She's now very skinny. Skinny. And for me, it's very, very beautiful.
Chris Evert.
It was a perfect rivalry. I mean, if you couldn't ask for 2 more different people, players, personalities, looks, you know, everything was polar opposite.
Coming out, I think, really helped me become the tennis player that I became, because then kind of, you know, you're free.
She brought her set of fans, I brought my set of fans, and it was really pretty intense and pretty unbelievable.
Game, set, and match. Lucia Navratilova.
They couldn't have been more different. They couldn't have been closer at the top of the women's game. Chris dominated on the clay of Paris, winning 7 singles titles there. But on grass, there was only one winner. They met in 5 singles finals. Martina won them all, but in those days, she couldn't win the hearts of the center court crowd.
I did get the acceptance early on, but then it disappeared. Being gay and winning, I think, was too threatening. Mm. You know, it was okay to be gay as long as I was losing. But when I started dominating, somehow I had an unfair advantage. I don't know how. And that support had really shifted.
After all her 9 wins, it was when she lost that Martina showed what Wimbledon meant to her, and the crowd took her to their hearts.
And a tremendous cheer for the former champion. And 1 or 2 tears for her, I suspect.
I did get a big round of applause. And I got the trophy and they just kept clapping. And that's when I broke down, because I realized they accepted me as an American and as a gay woman.
The crowds really embrace you. No matter who you are, no matter where you're from, they really are respectful, they're knowledgeable, and you feel appreciated. And, you know, but I think the crowds have a lot to do with the love that I have for Wimbledon.
But what do? When play is stopped.
Ladies and gentlemen, Cliff Richard.
Right. Oh, where... Now, hang on. What key would it be in? We're all going on a summer holiday. No more working for a...
As Wimbledon is hit by a deluge, the covers are pulled over the courts. Holiday, no more worries. A woman wrings out her summer cardigan.
Oh, my God, when it rained. We'd read the tabloids and have a laugh. And
Chrissy, look at Sue Barker. Keith Richards.
No, not Keith. What was Cliff. Cliff, sorry.
Not Keith Richards.
No, sorry.
I'm all shook up.
Cliff bows at the end of his impromptu concert.
Long before Sir Cliff shook Centre Court, a certain German teenager came to London and fell in love.
Everything I am, everything that I have, and everything that I will be is because of this court. So I have nothing but great memories. You know, I wouldn't change a thing. This place very much became my home.
In 1985, Boris Becker was unseeded and a complete outsider for the title.
I was 17, but I was already number 20 in the world.
But he powered his way into the final.
I felt, you know, there's something changing now, especially in the second week. I kept talking to more and more people. The press conferences were getting longer, but I wasn't afraid, put it that way. I slept pretty well the night before. I envisioned holding the trophy, which is something. I really stuck to my routine, and I didn't want to change anything from the semifinal to quarterfinal. Just obviously when I walked out, I was trying to be the first one. All this roar started, and I'm like, okay, where am I? It is a women's final.
Game and first. The power was obvious. The big serve was back. Plus, the Boris dive. It changed your life drastically,
yeah,
didn't it?
Until now. The reason we're talking today is because of the summer of 1985. It changed my life so much that I call Wimbledon my home these days. And it's never been the same. I call the 7th of July 1985 my birthday.
At some point, the youngster would falter against the experienced Kevin Curran, wouldn't he? Coming out to serve for the title, surely the nerves were kicking in then.
That's when I, for the first time in the match, I became a little nervous, a little frightened. First point double fault immediately. Another double fault on my first match point, and I just, you know, just prayed, God, give me one more serve. I need one more serve. And then there we go.
Boris makes an unreturnable serve. He throws his arms up in triumph.
There was a moment, and I felt, you know, walking to shake Kevin's hand, that something changed. Something dramatically is not going to be the same anymore. At that moment, I didn't know what, but he felt there was a change.
Boris lifting the gold and silver trophy.
If you win out here, you lose your privacy, period. That's the price you're going to pay. Some players didn't mind. Some players couldn't handle it. I had my moments of good and bad. I felt a lot of pressure from everybody, and I wasn't sure whether that was a one-time thing. It was just 2 weeks of never be repeated again. Or am I good? Am I that good? So for me personally, the defense was much more important the first time around because it installed me in an inner belief I belong in this tennis world.
Game, start and match, Rebecca.
Back-to-back championships, and the following year, he lost in the second round. Now came a test. How would he treat such an indignity?
I think you have one of the quotes of the championships ever when you lost to Peter Duin, and you went in the press conference and you said...
Yes. Well, basically, I lost a tennis match, you know. I didn't lose a war, nobody died, I lost a tennis match.
And everybody was stunned, and I said, yes, I lost a tennis match, that was it.
He would win again, and for a while, Germany would rule centre court.
Yeah. That's it, Steffi Graf. Wimbledon champion.
The roof closing over centre court.
Wimbledon was box office. What began as German interest in the Boris and Steffi show became an income stream from television that would change the face of Wimbledon.
Stand by, Johnny. When I go,
no expense is spared on practice facilities, tunnels that protect the stars from the mobbing of old. An international broadcast centre, the latest technology. And against our dear old weather, roofs. Looking ahead, respecting the past.
The good part about the All England Club is that they've kept a lot of the traditions, but they've come up in the 21st century too. So we sort of have the best of both worlds. And so the players appreciate it. I think it's a better experience for the fans than ever.
The wonderful thing about Wimbledon is tradition and innovation. And combining those two give it texture, but it still has that magic atmosphere about it. There's something magical about that place. Wimbledon, it's like a grandparent who you love, but who's totally up to date.
Wimbledon has an interesting way of staying relevant, staying very much in the moment, yet preserving history and tradition.
Boris had been the teenage sensation, fearless in his youth. But the next dominant force was about to appear.
A bank of photographers.
Pete Sampras, he took over your living room, didn't he?
I gave him the keys, I said that. You're the new owner of this court, and he's the best one I ever played on.
A brief rally.
It's just better. You know, on my very best day, and on his best day, he's just 10% better. And he's probably the reason why I eventually retired, because I said, you know, if I feel like I can't beat everybody I want to beat on this court, then what's the point of playing?
Game, set and match, Sampras.
Los Angeles, California. Pete Sampras.
Remember, I was like 10 years old, get up at 6 in the morning in L.A., and we would all sit around together and watch the final. It was sort of our Super Bowl in our sport. And as a kid, I just, you know, watching Borg, McEnroe, Becker winning at 17, Pat Cash winning there, those were big moments for me. So as a kid, I was like, okay, Wimbledon, that's the place I want to be. You know, that was it.
And what a moment for this delightful shot maker.
He is absolutely up there with the very best players who have graced this famous court.
The age of the man they called Pistol Pete. There had been Rod Laver, and now there was Pete Sampras. And 1999 was his year of years.
The performance of a maestro, and surely no one will argue that Sampras is the greatest grass court player of all time.
It was the best tennis I've ever played, bar none. People ask me my best match. It was sheer perfection. I almost felt embarrassed when I won sometimes. But I was all about the winning and the working hard and achieving goals. But the attention and the stardom, you know, I grew to accept it. I always felt like when I was the best player in the world, something was going to make me fall. That's why I always kind of had this recipe to keep it the same.
Keeping it fast and familiar. He won 6 times. Nobody had ever won 7 Wimbledon titles.
My parents there, I just got engaged, and life was just about perfect.
Now then, we have found the parents of Pete Sampras. Ah, the gentleman with the eyebrows, yes, a telltale sign. Sam and Gloria, their first time ever at Wimbledon, and as far as I know, their first time ever watching him in a Grand Slam final.
Oh, did they not see you play that often, then?
Well, they never saw me play live, and I wanted them to come to Wimbledon, and they never would.
Was that their choice?
It was their choice. I was always nervous to bring them over if I would have lost, or just my dad's superstitious. It was my dream to have them there.
Time.
Having been sat with a towel covering his face, Pete returns to the court.
They wanted to be away from it, but deep down, I missed them.
He looks emotional.
3 points for a seventh championship and a 13th Grand Slam title.
Please.
It was an amazing time after, you know, they were emotional, I was emotional, and
overwhelmed by emotion and with tears welling in his eyes, Pete cannot go on.
Sorry.
He takes a moment.
And I still get emotional about it, especially as I see my dad getting older now, and it's tough times as you see your folks get older. So I think about him in those moments and wish he would have been part of those a little bit more often.
And I think we just want to hear how much that meant to you.
It means so much to me. My parents were here today. They gave me an opportunity to play this great game, and I love them. I love my fiance, Bridget, everyone that really put me together these last couple weeks.
Bridget looks embarrassed.
My kids are 14 and 11 now, and you want to be part of those moments. And, you know, my parents weren't part of those moments enough for me. And I think I carry that a little bit today.
It's my home away from home, so I've grown to love playing Wimbledon, and I always will come back here, even as I'm done playing this great game, come back as a fan and sit in that roll box and enjoy these guys sweat it out.
He did come back to play twice more, but without winning again. Another new age was beginning.
I saw Leighton Hewitt play his first round match, and I was in Palm Springs, and I turned it on and I watched for about a half hour, and I'm like, God, I don't miss it. I don't want to be there. It had no emotion towards it. It was tired of the sport, was tired of the lifestyle. For me to say that about Wimbledon, you know, deep down, I'm officially 100% done playing tennis.
He's arguably the greatest champion of all time.
God, won seven times? I never thought that would happen. It's where I made my name. You know, people think of me, they think of Wimbledon.
Pete kisses the trophy.
The making of the name, etching a place in the list of the greats. Some are still in the process. Roger Federer, still going. Seven times the Wimbledon singles champion, equaling Pete Sampras. And no sign yet the Swiss master of precision is reaching that moment of saying, I am done.
Great moment, walking through the gates and asking where is the locker room and like where can we warm up, what are we allowed to do, when do we play, what's the routines and all these things. Everything was so new, and it's like living in a dream world once you entered the gate back in the day. I remember very, very vividly, actually.
Memories of the junior championship, which he won. Now he needed a breakthrough moment as a grown-up.
The 2001 fourth round against Sampras was a surreal experience.
A few times I was like, is this a dream or is this like reality? But then I said, I mean, this must be real, because this is an unbelievable feeling I have right now.
I remember warming up, you know, the 5 minutes with Pete hitting balls. I was so nervous. And then I would hit the ball, I would follow the ball, and then Pete would hit back to me. I go like, this is so cool. I mean, it was Pete Sampras on center court at Wimbledon. I mean, what else do you want?
Victory in five sets. he was on his way. The first to topple Sampras at Wimbledon in 5 years.
He had the whole package. Even at that time, you know, I just felt like, God, this guy serves pretty big, and he returns quite well, and he moves well, and he's got all the shots. And at that point, I said, this kid's going to be good. Little did I know he'd win 18 majors and do everything in the sport. But, I mean, I could see that he was going to be good. I just had no clue that he was going to take it this far.
Your first Grand Slam title, is that still one that is the most special to you?
Yeah, I think it was most emotional. It was so real.
I can tell how raw it is when people walk over, because it's just happened, and how so many emotions are going around.
Yeah, and I was young and I was unexpected and everything, so it was absolutely the most magical moment in my life, and my career could have stopped right then, and yeah, I would have been a complete human being and a tennis player, really.
Roger Federer, Wimbledon champion. You better get used to that.
Thank you. No, it's an absolute dream for me coming true, and I was always joking around when I was a boy. I'm going to win this, and now I have it.
And you've had so much support from back home and from everyone here. What's your message to them?
Oh, yeah, a lot of people came from Basel and home, and it's so nice, you know, to share this moment. And thanks to everybody. Oh, it's great.
Congratulations, Roger Federer.
He displays his trophy.
It became an annual event. Roger won the next four finals. He was the best of a golden generation. Tennis as it had never been played before.
Roger returns a shot from Nadal with an elegant but powerful backhand.
Rafa Nadal finally ended Roger's run in 2008 in a final to cherish.
When you're winning, it's easy to love you because you're supposed to be the best and everything you do is great and everything you touch turns to gold. But when you lose and you get the support, I think that means so much to you.
Roger waves to the crowd as he parades holding the runners-up plate.
He was soon winning again. If he won here in 2009, he would pass Bjorn Borg's five Wimbledon titles, pass Pete Sampras's total of 14 Grand Slam victories. Andy Roddick was his opponent on court, but not the only person in Roger's thoughts.
The record was on the line of getting to my 15th Grand Slam. My wife was pregnant with twins. Nobody knew that other than the family and my friends. And it was like this, you know, sort of perfect summer, really, for me.
Under the gaze of a former champion.
Roddick returns with a shot that soars straight up into the air. Sampras gets to his feet.
Between these two men.
Bjorn Borg was there, John McEnroe was there, and
Pete was there.
Pete was absolutely exactly. Pete came.
4.25 hours, 37 service games without being broken until that last game.
Yeah, no, I couldn't break Andy. He was playing that well, and my only break I got me the win. It was totally crazy, but it shows that you just have to sometimes mentally push and stay around and physically believe you can manage. And it paid off. It was amazing. I fell in love with the club, but not only just the atmosphere of the tennis tournament and its history, but also the people at the club. Everybody has always been so super friendly. And yes, I can't wait for the day to come when I will go there away from the championships, yeah.
Rows of green seats.
Champion Serena Williams, for me, the greatest of all time. But she won't be here this year. Perfect excuse, though.
Footage of Serena.
It's Serena Williams, 14 years after that first victory here. Grand Slam number 22.
Serena won't be here to defend. She's pregnant, so she can't add to her tally of 39 Grand Slam titles for a while. Last year's win was her 7th Wimbledon crown, her 22nd Grand Slam singles title.
My dream was never to win Grand Slams, and then all of a sudden it became my goal. And I wanted to win the US Open, and I wanted to win Wimbledon, and people are talking about you can equal Martina Navratilova and Chris Evert's record and win 18. I was like, okay, I want to do that. And then the next one was like, well, you can equal Steffi Graf with 22. And I'm like, okay, I'll do that too. I didn't grow up and say, oh, I'm going to win 22 grand sometime. That still doesn't sound right, but it happened.
And there's more. With Sister Venus, she's won 6 doubles titles.
This must feel like home now, this court.
Well, this court definitely feels like home, and love playing out here on center court, especially with my sister, who's just inspired me so much to be here and to be who I am.
Well, you've inspired many as well. Congratulations, ladies and gentlemen, Serena Williams.
Her achievements are there for the next generation to aim at, just as a young Serena found her motivation in an earlier era.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Peter Wilson with the BBC Film Unit speaking to you from the centre court at Wimbledon on the final day of the 1958 championships.
Althea Gibson won back-to-back championships in 1957 and 58. Almost 20 years later, Arthur Ashe won his Wimbledon title.
Coming up in the late 80s, it was like, wasn't many African-Americans playing, so it was like, you wanted to learn the history of all of them. So I read all the books about Arthur Ashe, read all the books about Althea Gibson, because I wanted to know the history and everything they went through, and it motivated me. We're all here to do our best and to inspire one another and to lift each other up and not to let anyone down.
There'll be something new for this year's championships. Her Royal Highness, the Duchess of Cambridge, has become patron of the All England Club. She's a fan of Wimbledon, and a Wimbledon great is a fan of hers.
It adds even more prestige to the tournament, seeing Princess Catherine there, Prince William. Who knows, maybe in the future we'll see somebody of those people giving the Wimbledon trophy as well. That would be beautiful, I think.
Roger Federer. Yes. Isn't he a joy to watch?
Absolutely. He's my mother's heartthrob. I don't think she's going to mind me saying that. I think he probably knows that too.
He's many people's heartthrobs.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Duchess of Cambridge.
Growing up, I've sort of watched Wimbledon. It's been very much part of my sort of family growing up. It's such sort of a quintessential part of the English summer. Mm. And I think it really inspires youngsters, myself. It inspired me when I was younger to get involved in the game. It hasn't changed either. I think that's what's so wonderful. And everyone's still there in their whites. Mm. Wimbledon still looks as amazing as it did, as I remember it. Mm. As a youngster, you've got the strawberries and cream. Every time Wimbledon's on, I'm there thinking, yes, I could do the same, get out of the racket. Sadly, never the same results.
Who did you enjoy watching?
I was really sort of taken by the likes of Agassi and Sampras, even Isovich and things when they were playing, for things like that. So that for me was, I suppose, my first memory of the players.
Did you ever go to the championships?
I did. My first chance at sort of going was queuing up on, I think it was a People's Sunday or People's Monday, I think, and being able to go into Wimbledon and sort of be part of what is so amazing there. The atmosphere there is incredible. Whether you're sitting on Henman Hill or being fortunate enough to be in and just wander around the ground courts, it's hugely special. And I was very fortunate that I did get through. It was quite late in the day, I'm not going to lie. But luckily, play went on quite late in the evening, so I managed to get to see some.
What are your favourite centre court games?
The Ivan Isovich game, where he got the wild card draw. It's because it was such a passionate game. That for me just shows, the sportsmanship behind tennis, and actually anyone has got a chance.
Do you get to meet any of the players during the tournament when you're there in the roll box?
Every now and again, that's what's so wonderful, is you sort of bump into somebody as they're walking courtside or to an interview or something. Yeah. And then after games, I try and say hello to players. I can remember actually walking past... my father's not going to enjoy this, but I remember walking past Tim Henman, actually, from under one of the show courts. And I was there with Dad and we got in. I'm very excited, just keeping a beady eye out on sort of who we could see. And I can remember walking past Tim Henman and we'd just seen Sampras play. And Dad, as he came past, said very coolly, "Hi, Pete." And I was like, "Dad, you can't do that. Utterly, I was mortified.
The most memorable moment for me and for so many people was Andy winning in 2013, the first British man to win in 77 years.
It was amazing. I was very heavily pregnant with George, so I wasn't able to turn up.
But you had a great excuse.
I know. But even still, I sort of was there, sort of thinking, maybe I could go. The doctors were like, definitely not. But no, I wrote to him afterwards. I said, sorry for not being there, but huge congratulations. It was great seeing all sort of the flags and everything like that and how the public got behind home players. I find it hugely emotional and I'm not even taking part.
Wimbledon does this to people. It makes a connection. It draws us in.
Let's have a walk, because it's so sort of different along here. Are you aware? Because there's so many fans who line up here screaming at you.
Yeah, you can hear them, yeah.
Do you take that in, or are you now just focused?
Yeah, pretty focused. The closer you get to going out there, you're nervous, but obviously as you start to make the walk, you're thinking, oh, you know, can I actually play tennis? I'm terrible. As soon as you actually get on the court, it's actually okay once you get out there.
Andy, last year, this to become a two-time Wimbledon champion. He gave a masterclass.
He's there. Straight sets again. Wimbledon champion again. A supreme performance. A first-class tournament. Andy Murray.
It definitely felt different to me, and the one thing that I made sure that I did this time was that I really, really enjoyed it. Like, the last time, there's a few things that I wish I'd done differently in terms of celebrating and everything.
I heard it was a big celebration.
Yeah, it was a big celebration. I said to my team, look, if I ever win a Grand Slam again, like, I'm doing what I want to do, I'm having my friends around me.
And for someone who doesn't really drink a lot of alcohol...
I don't drink, so imagine. I did drink a lot that night, and it wasn't pretty, but we had a good time.
Were you on the dance floor?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think so. I don't remember much about it, but I'm pretty sure I was. Yeah.
I think this bit is the most special for me. The wonderful, you know, the saying, the trophies, and this is such a magical place. Do you have a little glance off to the right as you come down?
Yeah, it's a shame we don't get to keep that one for the year. But it's obviously amazing. Amazing trophy, but that, I mean, it literally never leaves that.
No, except
on finals day. It's like a lot of security.
They won't let me touch it.
As soon as I've taken a photo with it, they like snatch it back off you and put it back in the in its box and off it goes.
For me, making this film has been far more than any professional assignment. From kissing the champions to sitting with my idols. I have laughed and cried with people I've played against and those I've admired from the stands.
You guys are the absolute tits of the world.
The one thing that unites us all is a love for this place. And as Bjorn explained, when it's in your heart, no one can ever take it from you. It will always be our Wimbledon.
Sue, have a happy holiday.
Thanks.
And take you. Care.
Stay on. You can't do that. Brilliant. Thanks so much.
Is that right?